always rain. There'll be days like this when there's no one complaining. There'll be days like this when everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Oh, my mama told me there'll be days like this when you don't need to worry. There'll be days like this when no one's in a hurry. There'll be days like this when all the parts of the puzzle start to look like they do. Then I must remember there'll be days like this when you don't need an answer. There'll be days like this when you don't need a chance. There'll be days like this when you don't get the trade by that old Jesus kiss. And I must remember there'll be days like this.
About little Van Morrison there. There'd be days like this. Mama told me there'd be days like this. This song is dedicated to Mama's Day, to all the she-wolf mamas out there. How about that? That's a nice little song. Mama told me there'd be days like this. And she was right. Hey, Terrible Tommy here. Tom Metzger in the bunker, right here where I should be, at my post with the most. Yeah. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Another beautiful day. Going to be a little bit muggy, but not bad. Yeah, nice and warm. Up in the 80s. How about that? Me and my gal had to go down to the storeroom this morning and drag out a couple of air conditioners that we'll have to put upstairs in the windows. Yeah, we got them out there. I don't think it's quite hot enough to put them on yet, but we're going to need them. In between times, when it's not too hot yet, and it's not cold, I put the box fans in the window. One end of our living room and kitchen, we put a box fan exhaust, and then we put an exhaust fan, intake fan at the other end, and then we turn on three ceiling fans, and man, we get a regular cyclone around here. A whole bunch of you have got your donations in for May. That's good. Appreciate that. And like I say, always remember, especially you PayPal payers, make sure that your email address is on there somewhere. Sometimes we only get a name, and then we forget, who in the hell is that? Of course, we've trained our memory to forget. That gets us out of a lot of trouble, not remembering. Somebody recommended walnuts to me. I think it was my daughter. She takes care of my health problems. I've been eating those walnuts every morning, a handful of them, and I got a feeling my memory is improving. I don't know whether you've ever tried that or not. You know, I want to share something with you people that I've known for a long time, but I don't talk about it too much. And that is, I wonder if you've ever studied the new discoveries in the tripart brain, the three divisions of the brain that evolved over millions of years. The simian brain, which was like about the size of a walnut, started on the top of the spine. And then it went to the mammalian brain, more in the center of the head. And finally, the humanoid brain. And that's, of course, most of the great stuff is in that frontal, what they call it, cortex. Anyhow, the frontal part of the brain. And that's where, if you're lacking, you got a problem. And that's why the Negroes basically are lacking, unless they gene hijack and get some good stuff off some of us. But there's another thing to that that fits in with it, and that is the fact that you've got subconscious, right? You all know about subconscious, right? You got conscious, and I hope you're all conscious. But then there's one they don't talk about much, and that is supraconscious. And that is my theory, is where your God thing comes from. That there's not actually some God out there floating around on the clouds. But your super consciousness is the God, a type of God. In other words, it's part of you. You're born with it. You don't want to get too excited and too narcissistic about it, but that's where it comes from. And homogeneous societies, of course, especially white, are much more intellectually superior and so forth. That's why they're always saying, I hear even all these liberals saying, well, look at Scandinavia, look at those countries. Well, until they started mixing, they obviously were superior to other cultures and races on the earth. Of course, they're ruining it all by diluting it. And that's another part of my theory, that homogeneous societies are like batteries, genetic batteries. That they, you know, some people have talked about the mass mind. And when you live in a homogeneous society, I think there is a mixing of all the people in the community over the years. Sort of like a battery, combining all the cells. And so you get a superior culture and superior people. Now, I'm not going to give you all the ins and outs about that, but that's basically my theory. And lots of times when people pray supposedly to some God out in the clouds, they're actually talking to their superconsciousness. And your superconsciousness can do things for you. So that's the name of the game. The frontal part of the brain being the latest development and evolution, and the bigger that area is, the more advanced. People can say, well, I don't believe that. Well, you can say, well, maybe the aliens seeded us some way down here, and that's what happened after they seeded us. It makes a hell of a lot more sense than all this Jesus and Yahweh stuff. But if you've never considered that particular way of thinking that I have considered for decades and decades, think about it. If you want to comment on it, comment. But laboratory research has pretty well ascertained this tripart brain answer to our human development. And then conscious, subconscious, conscious, and superconscious, another important factor. And the reason why homogeneous societies are always superior, especially white homogeneous societies. Very simple. They work together. They have even, you know, like my kids and I, some of my kids and I, we think about something that's going to happen before it does. We think about something at the same time one of the other kids do. Well, that was what Jack London called genetic memory. And that all works through that frontal lobes of the brain. And so when you say, well, how come blacks are stupid? Well, if you look on a true Negro, that front of their head slopes back. There's not near as much of that, what they call it, neocortex or whatever. That's the main part of the brain. It gets the genius. So anyhow, think about it. We'll go on from here. Well, you know, I listen to the Keyhole, a lot of these black shows. Yeah, yeah, I do. And so let's listen to what little bit of the black show from last night, okay? All right, here we go.
See, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe I'm just a pessimistic black man. I don't know. But I think Stokely Carmichael was right when he said America has no conscience. And I just think that we lose fact of that. We lose sight of that, and we just don't want to buy it and accept it. And I'm sorry, but I just don't think that between LBJ and MLK and JFK, they didn't legislate morality. And I just feel like mainstream white America, especially white males, you know, they feel the same way about black people, brown people, red people, yellow people, women, as they have for the last three or four centuries. And that's just what it is. And we can lie to ourselves and we can think otherwise, but at the end of the day, I don't think they progress much. They see the world the same way. And yeah, a jury of their peers will allow them to walk because Freddie Gray's life didn't really matter. He was just a poor black man, you know, and that's how this country's built. It's going to remain like that for a while. I mean, that's not something that dies in 1970, 1990, 2010. There's a whole other generation of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant conservative Tea Party people that can look at people of color, Americans of color, and they see us as second and third class, and they believe the police are there to protect and serve them, protect them from us, to serve them, to keep us on the right side of the railroad tracks, the right side of the rivers, the right side of town, where we live. You know, like the sundown laws. Be out of town by sundown, boy. That mentality is alive and well in America, and the police show us this every week. I mean, I think right now it's about 4 or 5 days we get some type of story you know, just, you know, I don't know, solidifies the whole notion that the police are here to oppress black men, brown men. That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah. Folks, we've got a mixture of calls on Baltimore, the police, and on Tom Brady. So we're going to put...
Well, there you go. That boy's got it figured out. I wonder how long it took him to figure that out. Of course we're racist. Of course we want the cops to serve us, the whites. Of course, it's all true. We've been that way not for a few hundred years, but thousands and tens of thousands of years. But this boy finally figured that out. How about that? Yeah, it's just the nature of the brute. Just like the deal where not the tarantula, but forget what poisonous bug or insect got on the back of that gopher that got it right across the river. And then the poisonous insect bit him, and they asked him, how come you bit me? I gave you a ride across the river. That's my nature. Hell yes. It's our nature. So I got a good idea for you, Mr. Black Man. Get out of Dodge. Get away from us. We're cruel. We're unforgiving. We're narcissistic. We're all those kinds of things. So get out of town. Save your ass. We're horrible. Yeah, okay. It's not going to change. You know how white people lie to you in polite conversation. You're the best friend I ever had, Rastus. I trust you all the way. Yeah, right. They speak with forked tongue. You'll get more truth out of a white racist bastard like me than you'll ever get out of these upper middle class and wealthy whites, you know. that swear, oh, you're equal. Yeah, you've been held back by my granddad or my dad or me. Wait a minute. Okay. Yeah, that's the way it goes. Like that plantation system where the overseer, he'd have his blacks that he sort of liked, he said, and they'd serve him well, and they'd kick the shit out of the other blacks and so forth and so on. And that's the way it goes. But he liked them. They made him lots of money. Boy, then people up there at Nike, the shoe people, the tennis shoe people, they're as fast as slippery as snot. A visit to Nike headquarters on Friday allows Obama to address at least two of the three. The giant athletic apparel company is pledging to create 10,000 jobs in the United States over 10 years with its manufacturing partners if Congress gives Obama fast-track trade negotiation authority that ultimately leads to the 12-country Trans-Pacific Free Commerce Agreement. Well, you know, if that ever happened, you know who those 10,000 workers are going to be? The same workers that they're sending to jobs overseas. They just import them in here, or the ones that are already here, you know, part of the 30, 40 million ones that are already here, the Mexicans or whoever. So it's going to be the same thing. Whitey, you're not going to get the job unless you want to work for slave labor wages. The company says a Trans-Pacific trade deal would allow it to benefit from lower tariffs on shoes and speed up company investments in footwear manufactured in the U.S. You know, I think more of those shoes are worn by Negroes than anybody else. What do you think? I do. They all have to have Nikes. Even if they don't have a job and they don't have any money, they'll sell some dope and buy Nikes. But the 10,000 jobs would be a small fraction of the overseas workforce Nike relies on for manufacturing. Of Nike's slightly more than 1 million factory contract workers. Did you catch that? 1 million, baby. More than 9 out of 10 are in Asia. Oh, that's really building up the Asian economy. With the largest number in low-wage Vietnam. Gee, I thought we fought a war over there. I think we still got bones and guts of American soldiers in the ground over there. Of course, we shouldn't have been there in the first place. And we shouldn't have killed a million people over there. But then to go over there and pay those people off is not a good idea. Nike, with such massive outsourcing of manufacturing, also provides Obama with an opportunity to talk about labor standards he seeks to enforce with the trade partners, particularly Vietnam, where the U.S. concedes that workers' rights protections fall short of international standards. Of the 11 countries that the U.S. is negotiating with in the Trans-Pacific talks, 7 have manufacturers that contract with Nike for shoes or apparel. I think Obama enjoys to be a plantation owner. Still, Obama's visit to Oregon has created a backlash. Nike represents what many liberal groups and labor unions criticize about trade deals: the potential for shifting U.S. jobs to other countries with cheap labor and few workers' protections. What's more, Nike has had to overcome a bad image over its foreign contractors. The only way you ever get these people to do right is by force, either by the force of law or the force of a gun. People have to rise up in these countries and burn those plants down. If they're not being treated right, burn those plants to the ground. Then these outfits would have to come back here to the United States. Anytime they build a big slave labor factory in another country, burn it down. Pretty soon they'd have to come back here. And then if we had the kind of leadership we should have, they'd give an offer they can't refuse, these corporations. We're going to raise your taxes to 95% tomorrow. and we're going to get some of this money plowed back into our system. But that's not going to happen because they're too far out in front of us now. We're too far out in front of us. And no matter how beaten down the workers get in this country, they don't seem to have the wherewithal to get physical like the labor unions of the old days and the Molly Maguires and so forth. No, people don't have the balls to rise up and clean house. And when things get really bad with 1% or 2% of the people in this country controlling most of the wealth, that's the only thing you can do. And if you don't have the balls to do that, well, just put up with becoming just like the third world. Just like the little Pakistani workers and the Vietnam workers and all these people. You can't even feed your kids. You don't have a house. You've got an old sheet metal shed to live in. It's going to happen here, boys. It already does happen in some parts of this country. Well, the urban poor in the United States are experiencing accelerated aging at the cellular level and chronic stress linked both to income level and racial ethnic identity is driving this physiological deterioration. These are among the findings published this week by a group of prominent biologists and social researchers, including a Nobel laureate. Oh, wow. Dr. Arlene Geronimus, a Stanford University professor and the lead author of the study, describing it as the most rigorous research of its kind, examining how structurally rooted social processes work through the biological mechanism to impact your health, unquote. Boy, that's a mouthful. I think I could have told them most of that stuff without even reading a book. What they found, the researchers analyzed telomeres of poor and low middle class black, white, and Mexican residents of Detroit. Telomeres are tiny caps at the ends of DNA strands, akin to the plastic caps at the end of your shoelaces. That protects cells from aging prematurely. Telomeres naturally shorten as people age. But various types of intense chronic stress are believed to cause telomeres to shorten. And short telomeres are associated with an array of serious ailments, including cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. Wow. Who would have thunk it? Evidence increasingly points to telomeres' length being highly predictive of healthy life expectancy. But simply, the shorter your telomeres, the greater your chance of dying, as in death. The new study found that the low-income residents of Detroit, regardless of race, have significantly shorter telomeres than the national average. Quote, there are effects of living in high poverty, racially segregated. They're blaming that on racial segregation now. I knew they'd get that in there. The life experiences people have, the physical exposures, a whole range of things that are just not good for your health. Yeah, that's what happens. White Detroit residents who were lower middle class had the longest telomeres in the study. In other words, they were doing better than the rest. But the shortest telomeres belonged to poor whites. So the weeding is out at the bottom, too. Black residents had about the same telomeres lengths regardless of whether they were poor or lower middle class. And poor Mexicans actually had longer telomeres than non-poor Mexicans. Geronimus said that these findings demonstrated the limitations of standard measures like race, income, and education level, typically used to examine health disparities. Quote, we've relied on them too much to be the signifiers of everything that varies in the life experiences of different racial and ethnic groups in the different geographic locations and circumstances, unquote, she said. Gotta watch these professors. Not simply racial ethnic identity, but the extent to which it is validated or discriminated against, or even understand within your everyday life experience, unquote, can affect an individual's health dramatically. Geronimus said, quote, race is not race. Yeah, right. Keep whistling past the graveyard. Poverty is not poverty. Early health deterioration is sensitive to a broad range of life experiences, unquote. I think she's trying to take you off the beaten path a little bit here. When ethnic identity impacts health, so why did poor Mexicans in this study have longer, generally healthier telomeres than non-poor Mexicans? Geronimus first noted that most poor Mexicans in the Detroit area were either first-generation immigrants to the United States or part of a close-knit ethnic conclaves. In contrast, non-poor Mexicans were more often born in the U.S. and were more integrated into the American culture through work or school. If they're immigrants, then they come from a different cultural background and upbringing that didn't stress that as Mexicans they were somehow other or lesser than other Americans, said Geronimus. Quote, they come from with a set of support systems and with a cultural orientation that doesn't undermine their sense of self-worth. Well, homogeneous neighborhoods, homogeneous communities. They then often live in these ethnic enclaves. Many of them don't speak anything other than Spanish, and they don't do that well. And so they're not interacted with Americans who view them as other or who treat them badly. It's not that they're immune to that treatment, but they're not as sensitive to it, and they also just don't experience it as often. See, they're because they're living in Mexican neighborhoods. In most cases, all Mexican. Same with the blacks. So no matter how bad things, they're going to feel a little better about things than people who don't. If a bunch of whites moved into that neighborhood, things would start changing. On the other hand, non-poor Mexicans are more likely to be exposed to some of the negative views of Mexicans held by some Americans, like Tom Metzger. The conflation of anyone of Mexican origin as being an immigrant or, well, he's an invader, or possibly an undocumented invader immigrant, or even more neutral assumptions like they must speak Spanish or they don't understand English. And that's good. When they were trying to push this in school, a second language of Spanish in Fallbrook, California, I fought it tooth and nail. You don't want these people to learn English, dummy. That puts them that much closer to getting a job. People say, well, you got to speak English. No, I don't want them to speak English. And then the next thing, they're taking out your blonde-haired daughter. You want them to be stuck with a foreign language. Or they don't understand English. Ironically, in seeking to become socially mobile and avoid the stress of poverty, these lower middle-class Mexicans may face even more pronounced stressors tied to their ethnic identity. Geronimus said the findings of the new study, based on the quantitative physiological research, line up perfectly with previous ethnographic studies of Mexicans in Detroit done by another researcher, Dr. Edna Veru Fuentes of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. A health site summarized the conclusion of Fuentes' work. I'm not going to go into that. This article goes on and on and on and on and on. But I think the main point it brings out is that these people move into the same areas, like people did when they first came to this country. The Italians, the Irish, and others. They did much better because they had a social support system and it worked out great for them until they were able to figure out a way of, through education or whatever, to break out of the situation. Gee, I thought they got rid of racism in Portland, Oregon. How about that? When they got rid of Tom Metzger and John Metzger. Portland, oh no, this is not Portland out there in Oregon. This is Portland, Maine. They got racism. Portland leaders gathered in front of City Hall today to denounce those who have been responsible for several racially charged incidents in recent weeks. That could mean anything from a murder to somebody painting a sign. Portland counselor John Hink said the problem is not easy to solve. Quote, if we as elected officials could pass a resolution, adopt an ordinance, set penalties that eliminated racism, hatred, and bigotry, intimidation forever, we'd do it, unquote, he said. It's not that simple. No, it isn't, City Councilman Hink and fellow City Councilor Jill Dusen said it's important that all the city's residents speak out against racism and bigotry. Hey, there's racism and bigotry here, man. Quote, we love free speech in our country. Okay, then why not free speech about race? We also have a responsibility to speak back. And I think that's part of what we're doing today. The recent incidents included what police call a racially motivated assault. Because probably two people, each of a different race, got in a fight. That's it. There's a wave of racism. And the spraying of offensive graffiti on a challah market. Mayor, I guess that's a Muslim market. Mayor Michael Brennan said such incidents have no place in Portland. They all say the same thing. You know when they say this stuff, they all say they have the same words. It's like there's a little book to talk about it. Quote, everyone should have the right to walk through Exchange Street and not experience racial slurs like nigger, wetback, and all that kind of stuff. Everybody should have the right to own a business in Portland and not have spray paint of an epithet on their building. Well, you don't have a right to own a business. Nobody has a right to own anything. Get that straight. Counselor Justin Costa organized the events. He said Portland officials at all levels, from legislators to counselors, were unanimous in denouncing the incidents. There you go. They're going to take care of that racism up there in Maine. Yeah. These people are amusing, the way they all come out, or a few of them come out and wring their hands and stomp their feet and say, we got to get rid of this racism. Yeah. It's only been around for 1 million years. We got to do it now. Guess what? There are 2.8 million Muslims in the UK, England, representing 4.4% of the population. So now they've started an all-female mosque over there. You guys stay out. See, normally it's all guys in a mosque. Now in this mosque, it's going to be all women, man. England, bye-bye. Boy, this Negro is unhappy. In the 4 years this Negro spent in London, Ontario, I've been called names like Ebony, Dark Chocolate, Shaniqua, Ma, Blackish, and Boo. I've encountered blackface on Halloween and been told to go back to my third world country twice. I've been pushed off the sidewalk by white kids. I've been humiliated by white guys shouting, look at the black ass, as I walk down the busy street. I've been an ethnic conquest for curious white men. I've witnessed my boyfriend get called a nigger over 20 times, been called you people, and been asked by white friends if it's okay to use the N-word around me while desperately trying to rap to Jesus. But yes, after all that, I went back to Jack, his friends, a month ago. A charmingly shitty bar that reeks of bleach and tequila, and where I spent most of my undergrad acquiring alcoholic gastritis. I feel my left ass cheek fly way up. I turn around and see this guy walking back to his table of cheering 20-year-old Justin Bieber's. Wow. I could have confronted them, but then I'd be that angry black girl. I could have slapped him, but after what happened at Aaron Frickranius, a healthy young 26-year-old who went into medical distress after being restrained by bouncers at Thorny Devil Nightclub, a short walk from Jack's, and died this February. No black person in London is safe from a perfectly normal bar scrape. I could have also dumped my nice, cool beer on his young, receding hairline, but that would be a waste of a $2.75 worth of beer. So instead, as I've been doing for the past several years in this city, I bit my nigger tongue and took it and allowed it. Minutes later, as I stood by the trough, a plaid-wearing white guy tried to introduce me to his only black friend. Quote, "Isn't he good-looking?" he said. The black kid smiled, and he looked like Urkel, whatever that is. I resisted the urge to tell this little fucker that just because he's black and I'm black doesn't mean there's a love connection. I downed my beer and walked away, wondering why the hell I bothered coming back to London. Obviously, nothing has changed. And the familiar feeling, this sinking, sickening feeling of uncomfortableness and humiliation was bubbling in my gut again, like it did every day I spent in this city, London, Ontario. The lights and the shitty music started me to be angry, and a random hand reached and grabbed my boob as I walked through the sweaty, jumping white kids who don't know how to dance. Oh, I see. Only black people know how to dance. I searched through the crowd looking for a black face, any face besides a white one. Only Urkel now. I was sweating and panicked. The buzz was gone. I couldn't be there anymore. I called my ex-boyfriend, Amir. That must have been a Muslim who lives in London. We haven't spoken in 8 months. He asked where I was. You already know, I said. Now come on and get me. London for black people, like Harvey Dent's face, beautiful, white, and smiling until he turns to the right. For me, London is still the place I call home, and yet it's a home that makes me feel unwelcome. And while some of the idiocy I experienced in London was unintentional, I love black people. Your English is excellent. Yo, girl, wagwan, this ignorance has rotted London to its core. They're so goddamn racist here, and has a long history of far-right ideology stemming back to the mid-1800s. London is an old white man in a Klan hat. Ironically, there's a time when London was considered one of the more accepting cities of black settlers. By the 1850s, London was an active little city that was home to some of the richest black settlers in Ontario. Many of them had come through the Underground Railroad as refugee slaves. But ex-slave Dr. Alfred T. Jones said that in London there was a mean prejudice that couldn't be found in the States. By 1863, segregated schools were in the works, but a lack of funding crushed the dream. Ala Osman, now a student at Western, tells me about growing up in London's school system. In grade 7, she asked her white teacher why they weren't talking about black history. Quote, his answer was, because it's not important, unquote, she tells me. A few days later, the same teacher put together a slideshow of brutalized slaves. Quote, a slide came up with a black man being lynched, Osman says. Quote, my teacher pointed at a picture and said, there is a nigger. This is a nigger. Osman never reported it because she wasn't sure if it was the actual issue. I was so young, I knew that I was uncomfortable, but I couldn't articulate why. It's not surprising considering the city's supremacist history. The Ku Klux Klan made their grand debut in London by 1872. A decade later, a group of white hoodlums burned down a house of a black man named Richard Harrison. More than a century after that, fearing we'd eat up all the white people, the white supremacist group Northern Alliance formed in 1997 and is still active today. The esteemed group even has its own mailing address on Richard Row, the city's main drag. I often replay an escape scenario in my head should I ever be waiting for a bus late at night across from their office. I think I'd pull a Tyler Perry in a Madea Christmas when she stumbles across the KKK meeting in the barn. She pounds the pavement, running, tits flapping and all. Luckily, I had no tit flapping moments while I lived in London. Although I did come face to face with a white supremacist neo-Nazi at a Jewish friend's wedding. Ironically, he was the best man. He seemed a little too eager to hold my hand during the horror dance. I'll bet you ebony porn is his favorite pastime, although he tried to brush it off by calling me a nigger girl all night. I'd have been more afraid if he wasn't Persian and morbidly obese. White pride marches freak me out more than fat, sweaty Persian kid who's a convinced Aryanist. I was probably hung over on March 24, 2012 when boneheads decided it was a lovely day to show a little white pride. However, anti-racist protesters scared them off. If white pride marches are something entirely strange to you, you should also know that they frequently are sponsored through the generosity of the Southern Ontario Skinheads, SOS. Take, for example, this fucking idiot who would like to thank SOS for the invite, warm reception, and hospitality. Basically, they flare up in London like a pimple with roots. When I speak to Barbara Perry, a professor of local science, social science at the UOIT specializing in hate crimes, she's not surprised. London has a lengthy history of viable right-wing extremism that's been visible for much of the last two centuries, she says. The fact that they don't have to hide says something. According to 2010 statistics, Canada data, London ranked fifth in all Canada at 8.1% of the police reported hate crimes. In Ontario, Guelph ranked first at 15.2%, followed by Peterborough in Ontario at 12.3%, and Kitchener at 10.5%. But need not worry, Londoners, Hamilton's black community remains the greatest target of hate crime. While the number is uncertain now, London newspapers covered the most amount of hate crimes from 1997 to 2000 of all the Ontario dailies. I found an 2002 Western Gazette article about a black female student who was punched in the face by a white guy after leaving a bar. The reason? She asked what his shirt said. The answer? The shirt said, "I hate motherfucking niggers." So she asked him, "What does that mean?" No wonder he punched her in the face. I've had eerily similar experiences, though minus the violence. 10 years after the Gazette article, a drunk asshole asked me and my ex, Amir, where he and his friend could get food. When Amir answered, the drunk tard told him to shut the fuck up, then turned to me and said, "Go back to your third world country, you bitch," as he approached, promising to beat the shit out of me. Naturally, I told him his father loved third world country women and turned to leave. Quote, "Your boyfriend is a nigger," he yelled, and the Jerry Springer bell went off in my head. It took two guys to hold me back while his horrified friend pulled him away, apologizing. Amir didn't flinch at being called a nigger. It was something he was used to since he started driving a cab 2 years ago to pay for school. Most of his nights consisted of being treated like shit by entitled drunk white boys. But Amir told me white female students were worse. He'd let me listen through his phone. They would take off their panties, tell him they love black guys, tried to grab said black guy's junk. Once a girl leaned and said, "What would happen if I sucked your dick right now?" and would ask him to come inside. One girl even got into the front seat against my will, he tells me. When her friend started arguing with her, she said, "Just let me be with a black man for 10 minutes. Sounds like a dream. Mostly they would call him nigger, a fucking immigrant, beat him with their purses, make fun of his English, and threaten to tell the police he raped them if he didn't give them a free ride home. Last October, Amir picked up 2 female students from Jack's. When he asked one of them to repeat the address, she said, "Do you know how to speak English, Negro?" Her friend asked why she was being such a bitch, and she replied, "Because they're so annoying." But Amir is unfazed. People think that we're shit, like you're somebody that came from the village yesterday, he says. Western University's zero-tolerance policy for racism and sexism was part of the reason naive 18-year-old me decided to go there. But when I got there, I was the token black person, and nobody wanted to talk to white kids walk through me like I didn't exist. During a class discussion on racism in my third year, an offended white girl raised her hand and said, quote, "Like, I don't get why we're still talking about slavery. Like, it's done. Get over it." Like, that girl made the mistake of forgetting there were 2 black girls in the class. We chewed her up. But surprisingly, she still didn't give a fuck about slavery. White kids at Western were also dealing with a lot of stress this Black History Month. On February 9th, a student hacked the Recreation Center's Twitter account and posted a tweet that said, quote, "Fuck all niggers." It was taken down and the university has since apologized. But it gets better, I promise. Days like the Gazette published a Black History Month edition. A comment ran in the Dear Life section that read, quote, "Why does it seem that the point of Black History Month has changed from celebrating black culture to making white people feel bad for being white," unquote. The day before, I spoke to an international first-year student, Salha Hamad. She was walking back to her room in a residence when she noticed the word "nigga" scrawled on a clean white wall. She wrote a post-it note, condemned it, and taped it to the wall. When she came back hours later, the note was crumbled on the floor and stepped on. Almost 2 weeks later, the writing was just been painted over. Like, how do you not see this, she says. Perhaps the biggest eye-opener to racism in the city in London, Ontario, was the recent deaths of Furcanonis on February 15th at Robison Hall / Thorny Devil. According to the video footage, Furcanonis was restrained outside the club by bouncers after knocking a guy out around 3 a.m. on February 14th. He was unresponsive and taken off life support the next day. A candlelight vigil for Furcanonis was held on February 22nd, and a petition urging for transparency has over 1,700 signatures. Some in the black community have boycotted the club. Also, and I'm sure the whites are glad they boycotted the club. Also calling out Cobra, Jim Bob Ray's, and Jack's for their ill treatment of black people. A business owner known as Frisch tells me since moving from Toronto to London 12 years ago, bartenders have refused to serve him or even let him in because he's black. I can barely count the few times I've seen a black man start a bar fight, and I partied almost every night for 9 months straight. Every Thursday, black people would go to this event in the black house of the local bar. No surprise, it was the only night in the city that had scanners and pat-downs. Meanwhile, white guys would kick the shit out of each other's roofie girls in a nearby alleyway and smoke weed right outside the clubs, and the bouncers had the shits and the giggles watching. What a coincidence that none of them died. Wow. But also of importance, how does London, Ontario make us feel? Ahmad, who is originally from Tanzania, feels that racism has taken over her life since moving to London. Quote, I'm anxious. I have heavy breathing. I have constant images of being attacked by white people, she said. Wherever I am, I'm always aware of where the doors are so I can run away. I'm in constant fear of white racists. Luam Bertha, a Western student and vice president of the Black Student Association, feels that she is carrying a burden by virtue of just being black. Quote, it may not be your history, but it makes it your history, she says. I agree with Bertha. Growing up mixed race with my mom's Pakistani family, I suddenly took to the full heaviness of being black in 4 years. I went from never thinking about race to seeing it everywhere. I've morphed from MLK into Malcolm X. I'm skeptical of white people. The world is no longer full of rainbows and unicorns as it once was, but now full of dead black kids in Klan hats. But more than anything, I'm tired. Haven't met a black person in London who isn't. The comments, the glances, the denial, the jokes are mentally exhausting. Honestly, I don't know what can be done for this city. The people making progress in London are the very people experiencing racism, and that's the biggest problem. The actual inhabitants don't care whether it's a banana peel thrown at a black NHL player at a city councilor. Signs being vandalized by fried chicken and watermelon, Londoners have no shame, and it's embarrassing. They are surely racist, through and through. But in a strange way, London has shaped my identity. It's made me critical, strong-willed, educated, and most of all, experienced. It's where I became an adult and where I made the most epic memories. But it is an asshole. A big, gaping, racist asshole that will shit you out once you're inside. Back into the white porcelain pot called life and flush you into the sewage tank with the rest of the shit, condoms, and dead goldfish. But I'd rather be down there than with the trash on land. That was a black girl in London, Ontario. So we're going strong in London, Ontario. See, racism can't be defeated. No way. It's never going to be defeated. Yes, that's true. Where am I at here? Okay. Let's put that on pause. Okay. Well, there's a new book on the market called White Flight: Atlanta, Georgia, and the Making of Modern Conservatism, Politics of and Society in the 20th Century, paperback. Oh, I guess this was printed clear back in 2007, but anyhow, it's called White Flight, and it centers on race in around Atlanta. During the Civil Rights era, Atlanta thought of itself as a city too busy to hate, a rare place in the South where races lived and thrived together. Over the course of 1960s and 70s, however, so many whites fled the city for the suburbs that Atlanta earned the new nickname, the city too busy moving to hate. There you go. That's available from Amazon. Yeah. Well, I see that three or four of the politicians over there in Britain who were openly critical of the Jews lost their positions and their seats, proving that the Jews still have a great control of the British government and the press. So anyhow, that's what's going on there, and of course, it's going to be seem interesting. Now, one of them has said he's going to run for mayor of London now. Quote, is it true there are plenty of other anti-Israel MPs out there, but these two in particular often cross the line by openly flirting with anti-Judaism? Their defeat is important at a time of anxiety for British Jewry. We're facing a worrying rise of anti-Judaism, noted Soffer. Galloway's antics recently included one of his party's PR people booting a Jewish reporter from an event and pointing out that he was a Jew, at which point Galloway's crowd turned on the man and began physically assaulting him, calling him a fucking Jew. The MP also recently declared his constituency an Israel-free zone, prompting charges of racism, which were also made after he walked out of a public debate when he found out his opponent was Israeli, snarling, quote, I don't debate with Israelis, unquote. As for Ward, he's made a long series of harshly anti-Israel tweets condoning terrorism. During last summer's terror war on Hamas, he wrote, the big question is, if I lived in Gaza, would I fire a rocket? Probably yes. Before International Holocaust Memorial Day in 2013, he was accused the Jews of not learning their lesson in the Holocaust. And that same July, he was tweeted, quote, am I wrong or am I right? At long last, the number Zionists are losing the battle. How long can the apartheid state of Israel last? And after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took part in a January anti-terrorism march in Paris following the attacks that included the murder of four Jews at a kosher supermarket, Ward tweeted, Netanyahu's in the Paris march. What? Makes me feel sick. Let's see, what else they got here? That's about it. So anyhow, the openly anti-Jew politicians got booted, so they're going to have to figure another way of getting back in there. That's right. Well, that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow with another shoe for you, 14-5, and have a nice day and have a nice evening on Ladies' Day here in the bunker, She-Wolf Day.